There are so many, right? I like Red Man. I think that's a great one too. I really like that one too. You know, read a lot about it and thought a lot about it.
It's like, he's like, you would like that one because he dies. So there's, we can't be disappointed by how unwell he
exactly.
is.
Exactly. So he died in the First World War, you know, and that's amazing. You know, we would never know what happened. Right. Yeah, if he worked or not, that's just great. That's my kind of patient.
That's your kind of
case. All right, that's great. Okay, moving on. Do you feel that there's a I don't know, there in the U.S. now, obviously it's impossible for me to know, even with all the, you know, technology. It's something about the field, so it's difficult to perceive it from here. But here in Brazil, definitely we've been experiencing something of a comeback from Freud. Like, yeah. Everybody's talking about it again, you know, books are being published again. You have like a gajillion fucking YouTube channels about Freud, and everybody's getting into it, and you have a lot of people saying crazy stuff, and you have a lot of academic people fighting those first guys. So I don't know, how does it feel there?
I think it also feels like it's coming back. I mean, I've been able to publish in places that 10, 15, 20 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to publish because they were squarely in what they called the Freud Wars against Freud. You know, probably most importantly, the New York Review of Books, which was run by, that guy.
And Frederick Cruz, right? Come on. He wrote most of
this. Frederick Cruz. He was pissed about one of my articles and like wrote a letter, but they ignored it.
He wrote you a letter?
He wrote the editor a letter saying,
oh my God. Frederick Cruz could go to analysis. Frederick Cruz is highly damaged. You know, like, I mean, I don't know what's going on with him, but what is this personal vendetta? I read that book and I was like, what the
I think he had an analyst that he hated. He had probably a bad analyst, and the guy sucked and he hates that guy. And so he spent his transference. He's expending his transference by trying to destroy any positive perspective on psychoanalysis.
He's just writing lies. I mean, you know, it's not, he's just like, you know, he's trying, it feels ridiculous to read that book, you know, the what is the name of it? The Making of an Illusion? Is that the book?
Yeah. Oh, is it the cocaine one?
Yeah. Oh yeah. My God. Jesus.
Yes. Freud, right?
Oh my God. Again with the cocaine talk, right? I can take that shit anymore. It's just like, yeah, come on. Give us a break, you know, about the cocaine talk.
Why are people so... I don't, like, who cares? Yeah, he did cocaine. And
you feel like telling people, have you ever done cocaine?
Right.
No? Maybe you should. You know, just give it a shot. You know, like, yeah, see what happens, you know, and then stop bitching about it. Right? It feels so, I don't know. It's weird. It's just weird.
Yeah. I mean, at least his excuse for doing cocaine was he was also like investigating it. The rest of us cocaine users don't have any excuse.
There you go. What do you want to do, like party on a Saturday night? The guy was trying to change the world in a way, or at least trying to help his friend, right? Who he eventually killed. But, you know, that's not the point. It's just like, you know, he was trying to do something. Oh my God, that's so boring. I read that article of yours in the New York Review of Books. It's just so good, you know? That's good. I want to congratulate you personally on that one.
Oh, thank you.
That is so good.
And that's been very kind to me.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I even though I was reading and thinking, how the hell did they actually let her write, you know, this here? It was still like, so. What was that? They just came to you and asked you?
No, I mean, it's a nice story. It's I had wanted to write this thing on pharma. On psychopharmacology. And then when I was publishing the last book, Conversion Disorder, I thought it might be a nice kind of thing to do in like kind of commemoration of the book. It's like, what's different about psychoanalysis from taking drugs and this question of kind of conversion and the body. So I had this idea of short pieces that were devoted to the category, you know, benzodiazepines, antidepressants, sleeping pills,
that's
so on
it,
and
yeah,
so forth.
Yeah.
And I used to write for The Guardian. I wrote an article on Trump in 2016 before he was elected in June. Mm-hmm. And they wanted me to do like a kind of garden variety psychoanalysis, like mom, dad, brother, sister, whatever kind of a thing. And I didn't want to do it at the time. I just didn't want to. I wanted to speak to something else, which was what kind of a symptom was he for America? So So I wrote that and they weren't particularly happy with me. They published it anyways, but they were pissed because they wanted this other thing. And they thought it was their moment to trot out their psychoanalyst and like make her do a psychoanalysis of someone. And I said, ethically, that's I don't nice. Actually agree yeah. with this. So I sent them this giant thing that I had done on the drugs. And they said, it's too intellectual for us, but let me send what? It. Yeah, they said, but let me send it to our friend. And so they sent it to the New York Review of Books, and the guy was like, I'm in. So it's really nice. Yeah.
That's just great. Yeah, it's just amazing.
Yeah, that was the editor at The Guardian, Amana Fontanella Khan. She's great. She wasn't happy with my article, but she helped me.
She helped you out somehow. Yeah, yeah. Definitely, yeah. That's great. I don't know there, but you know, that's something I'm really curious about as well. It's just what is the you know, like here in Brazil, I can't speak for South America. I can't even speak for Brazil. I mean, I know a couple of guys, you know, I'm just like, you know, like shooting the breeze here. It's just, it feels like there's this idea of you know, like the psychoanalyst. What he's supposed to look like, what he's supposed to act like, what he's supposed to like dress like, you know, there's this whole thing, you know, is it like that in the US as well?
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's certainly perfect. when I was in like the most strict classical training, and it was pretty severe. I used to joke with my former professor who went through the same training. She was like, she's like, oh, I used to wear my hair in a bun. Like, that's what women were supposed to do. You had to have like the pantsuit on with your hair in a bun and the glasses. You were supposed to make yourself like really drab. And I even was reading an interview with Hannah Siegel at the British Psychoanalytic Society, where she talked about, you know, like how you're not allowed to, she doesn't allow herself to wear any jewelry that stands out. That everyone in the institute knew this, that this was her theory of how the analyst has to look. So they bought her a very demure pocket watch when she retired from the institute.
That's a great story.
It's kind of amazing. So no, it still is that way. I got in trouble when I was in grad school for the way that I dressed. And like for a while I tried to look like what I was supposed to look like, and I gave up. And I remember an argument I had with this professor where he was saying, like, the students were asking questions, like, why do you, what is this neutral presentation of the analyst? Like, doesn't that actually communicate something in itself? And he was saying that if you were really integrated as a person, and so like, if you were flamboyant, but it was integrated into you, it'd be okay. But if it displayed your lack of integration, then it would be a problem. I just remember looking at this guy, and then he looked at me, because I just hated him for saying, and he looked at me and he goes, you know, like wearing 6-inch high heels, because I used to wear high heels. Okay. And I sort of looked at him like, what, like, do you think it's not integrated into me enough? Or
so how about that, right? Yeah.
Right.
That's just
he called me a downtown kind of a person. Like he's like, I don't know, you know, maybe if you're a downtown kind of a person, you could wear those shoes. And I realized I got my office is in Soho, which I couldn't have predicted at the time. It's when I first started graduate school. And I was like, oh, look, my office is exactly where he said it would be.
After all. That's fascinating. I don't know, here it looks a little, I don't know, it just feels a little boring, and there's always this competition, which I suppose is pretty common in any area or field or whatever. You always have that. That's a common thing, right? People are competing to know, like, you know, who read more Lacan, or who, you know, knows more about this and that. And, you know, you always have this kinds of stuff, which I suppose it comes with the territory. Okay, I'll take it. That's okay. That's fine. But it doesn't really translate into authenticity, because at the end of the day, most of these guys, they look like, you know, your long lost uncle who was, I don't know, into the real estate business. And it feels phony. It feels like, I don't know, a character in a soap opera that is supposed to play the analyst. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just such a weird thing. I don't mind. I mean, if you, you know, that's okay. I'm cool with that. But it's just that not allowing people to be a little different and sort of stigmatizing people because of that, it feels a little weird, you know, it feels a little strange. You know?
But I think it's the professionalization of the field and the institutionalization of analysis. I mean, if you think of what it was in Freud's time and certainly what was going on for Lacan in the beginning, at least for him, they didn't have this institution. They didn't have the possibility of aligning with medicine or the university. It was just them in their offices. And I mean, Freud allowed for incredible variation amongst his you know, like original colleagues and the women and the men and, you know, the poets and the people that he saw. You know, he fought with them theoretically and he didn't like when they verged too much. But as people, I think there was a real acceptance of the diversity of, you know, who surrounded him to a certain extent. And then once you start putting this into a formal training, you know, I think that these things get very stultifying. You know, and there's a huge issue, which I was just reading about, which is the question of the selection of candidates. You know, this idea that you have to pre-screen people when they're becoming analysts to make sure they're not psychotic or they're whatever. And analysts know that it's your analysis that's going to make you the person who's going to be an analyst. You can't see that. You know, if you take the person from where they are when they come, on what criteria are you going to base it? You're just going to end up keeping the worst and you're going to end up getting rid of the best and keeping the worst because you're going to keep people who you think look like something that you want to call an analyst, as opposed to someone who's gone through an experience and arrives at the place in which they can call themselves a psychoanalyst.
I see, yeah.
So we have real problems as a field because we're trying to pre-select people rather than allowing this to be a situation where who you are and your desire, like the 90s, brings you to the place where this is eventually what you do. At the same time that we need to train people. I mean, we do need to provide them with training. So we haven't figured this out. I mean, I think it's why the field is a mess.
Well, it's no different here. I can tell you that you have a shitload of institutions and they're, you know, forming people and everybody's studying and taking classes and paying money and doing all these things. And then you have the most, you know, these guys from the academia, from really big institutions here, big universities here. And these guys are trying to sort of like this, you know, disqualify like, okay, you guys, you know, you're doing it from an independent one. That's not good enough. You got to do it from us. You got to come in here and do it here. So, but you know, my problem with that, you know, my beef with that is the fact that, you know, I don't know when I listen to these guys talking, when I get to like read what they write, it just feels like so alienating, you know, it's just so alienating. It's just like so crazy. You know, I don't know why we have to make it like, so complicated, you know? Like they are trying, that's the idea I have, at least from academia here, is that they're trying to make it as complicated as possible, you know, so that, you know, you're going to have like fewer fellas coming around and trying to do this. You know what I mean? Yeah. And it's just like, so, this is so crazy to me, you know, like, because we could really use a lot of psychoanalysts here, you know, this is technically, I know it sounds insane, but it's technically something new here. You know, like a lot of people don't even know what he means. You know, they don't even know the difference. You know, they're just like, oh, that's the same as, you know, a psychologist, or that's the same as, you know, yeah. So you know, it's strange.
Well, I mean, in the United States, no one has, it's very, very rare that you come across someone who knows the difference between a psychoanalyst and a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist or a social worker. I mean, people really don't. There's no place for public education. Unfortunately, if you become a psychoanalyst who's like a public intellectual, you're still speaking to a very, very small crowd. Yeah. I do more of that than most people, but it's still a very selective audience of people who read the New York Review of Books, you know, or even with like, you know, and you know, maybe once in a while it gets out into other places or via podcasts or via, you know, some of these things, it reaches people who don't, you know, who can then hear about the difference, but it's very sad.
Yeah, it is.
How we've, you know, we're in this very, very diluted place. So you have this incredible narrowing of psychoanalysis into an academic jargon. You have no public representation, and then you have 500 competitors.
Yeah, why would anyone choose to do that, right? I mean, it feels like it's either a calling or it's like a suicide mission, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just so insane. Yeah. Yeah.
It takes no one. One of the things I always bring up is that to be a psychoanalyst takes 30 years of school. I mean, you know, you had to go to undergrad, then I had to go to graduate school, then I had to go to 10 more years of psychoanalytic training. And you could get a master's in counseling in 2 years.
There you go.
And hang up a shingle.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah, that sounds insane, right? That sounds just crazy, right?
Crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, I don't know. It feels weird when I stop to think about it, you know? And when I start reading stuff, you know, I start reading stuff from people that are trying to, I don't know, instead of making it more accessible and more interesting for fellows that are not really familiarized with the idea, I don't know, it feels like they're trying to manufacture some importance based on their, you know, fear of rejection or whatever, just by, you know, projecting all those things into, you know, like gajillion articles no one is going to read because they are trying to, you know, to talk in a language that is like Finnegan's fucking Wake. You know, it's just like, I don't know what's the point of that. You know, I really don't know. It feels a little, you know, counterproductive.
But Freud and Lacan, like if we just take them, but I mean, even if you throw Bion in there, Winnicott, we're in an amazing position in which they could hold themselves to kind of a rigorous standard.
Yeah.
Of intellectual life, they could force themselves to invent a new discourse and somehow still manage to appeal broadly. You can't do that anymore.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, like
that's...
I play a lot of games where I go this way for this thing and I go this way for another, but it's very hard to imagine inventing a discourse and then also allowing that to go public. And I think it's just the time. I think it's Paris 1960, and I think it's, you know, whatever, sort of Middle Europe, Freud 1920s.
That's it, right? Yeah. Those were the times, yeah. Definitely, definitely, definitely. Do you think, one of the interesting things I think about you when I read your stuff and I read about you and everything, it's just that, yeah, that feels very fresh. The fact that you're trying to do a lot of different stuff that most psychoanalysts wouldn't do, you know, that you're going to do a podcast or then you're going to, I don't know, be in a public appearance, you're going to read something and you're going to be doing all these things, you know, it feels really fresh and it feels really interesting for a younger psychoanalyst. Like, oh, that's actually possible, you know,
yeah.
That's interesting. It's kind of interesting to do that. It's kind of interesting to have a dialogue with people in such, you know, such a close way, you know, that is like, you wouldn't imagine somebody doing that, you know, like that these days. So.
I mean, New York, I have to say, has been a big part of it. I mean, there still is in New York a kind of amazing cultural, like, you know, it's still, New York is still this melting pot of cultures, and you've got the art world and you've got the fashion world and you've got, you know, a huge background of sort of so many of the literati are here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's very like, there's something in New York. It's like, once you break through the screen, then you're just, you know, then you're like invited to all the,
all right.
And then, you know, everything is possible at that point. So, I mean, I really figured out how to push something, I think, in a lot of directions, and they love psychoanalysis, you know.
That's
so
it wasn't
like, you know, and I very much appreciate the conversations that I've tried to build like within my own field, but I also was interested in what they were interested in me as an analyst, because
I see,
you know, the people, for example, in the art world, psychoanalysis was extremely important to art theorists back in the 60s.
Definitely. Oh, yeah,
and
oh,
in
yeah.
their mind, you know, like that's the heyday and they want to tap into that. And so then they have somebody to do that. So I'm like, let's go, let's figure this out.
Definitely, yeah.
You know, and it was also still so much in the, on the TV, you know, it was like Sopranos and Mad Men, and all of this is very New York centric. Yeah. I mean, obviously Woody Allen, but it was even, you know, sort of post Woody Allen, it was turning up on, you know, on the screen. So
definitely, yeah. Well, you mentioned Mad Men and The Sopranos now, and it's just so great, right? The Sopranos is like one of what is that? It's the greatest freaking TV show ever. What are you watching now? Do you watch, like you said, you don't read contemporary stuff. You also don't watch, like, what are you in the Brady Bunch?
I watch.
Okay, what do you watch? What are you watching now?
I mean, the one thing that I've watched that I found pretty gripping was Normal People.
Okay.
And I had seen Sally Rooney speak, and I was interested in her, but I hadn't read her. I hadn't read her because I don't read contemporary fiction so much.
Okay.
But I did, so I watched it and then I read her book, and I thought it was a fascinating depiction of méconnaissance in a sexual relationship. Very beautiful. I mean, the intimacy that's possible, but that somehow doesn't necessarily lead you to understand or be able to speak to one another, which, you know, you think of as maybe part of youth and a first love, but actually what's part of that first love is the capacity for intimacy because it's so new. That you can imagine with all of the misunderstanding that takes place between lovers could add up to a kind of hardening in the relationship between the sexes. And I can't think of another show that depicted this so well in recent memory. So I'm sort of fascinated by that. And I'm also watching Succession for all of its Oedipal themes.
Oh, yeah. For sure, yeah. Yeah, my wife is into that. Yeah, she's watching that one too. Yeah, that's cool. Do you listen to contemporary music? Do you listen to anything like now?
Do I listen to anything? I have this like sort of obsession with men with falsetto voices.
Okay.
I don't know what it is. It's the person who's always looking for the hermaphrodite in me.
Okay, that's a nice explanation.
So there's like a kind of James Blake, which continues my like electronic past. I like James Blake a lot. I like this band called Rye from Canada. Every time he's in a relationship, it has to go bad and then he makes an album. It's the only time he can make an album is when he's in despair. And then you have to wait 7 years for him to start a relationship and then have it go wrong to get another album out of him.
You're kind of rooting for it, right?
Yeah. I'm like,
just go, please break up. Yeah, that's great. Fantastic. But those are nice ones. Yeah, that's for sure. I remember I was listening to a podcast. I don't remember if I was listening to podcasts or if I was reading something, like an interview with you or something like that. And you coined a term that I thought it was like interesting, and I was really curious about it. I really wanted to talk to you about that, which is you said something called you kind of said, you know, this is voodoo psychoanalysis. You know, like when you do voodoo psychoanalysis. Do you remember that? Do you remember that thing? I don't know if you still
remember, but it sounds like something I would say.
It's like voodoo psychoanalysis when you just tell people exactly the whole, like, instead of having them figuring it out by themselves, you just go all the way and you tell them, right. You know, and everything. And I thought that was such an interesting term. I was like really curious about it, you know, if that's a, of course, that's a mistake, that's wrong, you shouldn't do it, right? But, that's the point. I don't know if it's a mistake or if it's wrong, even you shouldn't do it. That's why I wanted to ask you about it.
Well, I think you can deploy these things. It depends on your tact. I mean, if you act like someone who constantly, you know, has this magical voodoo quality to them, you're going to be in big trouble. But if it's something at a moment in which you do it and can have real impact on the person, I don't think that's a mistake.
I understand.
Or it's not automatically a mistake. I also talk about tea leaves psychoanalysis, which I like a lot. You know, this kind of thing where they say, like, in the first session, the final session will be present. But you will only know until you're in the final session that all of the elements were there.
Yeah.
Transference, the dissolution of the transference, the fundamental fantasy. And I don't know. I think that's right. I think it's, it has this quality of this omniscient 2020 retrospective capacity that's possible, and maybe that's a problem. But I also think it's right, this idea of the absolute overdetermination of elements. The overdetermination of the unconscious. And doesn't mean that there's not room for contingency, but contingency makes sense as the opposition to the overdetermination of life, you know. Mm-hmm. So you're stuck repeating whatever it is that you're repeating. And then there's the amazing moments in which you're freed from that momentarily.
Yeah, yeah. That's the goal, right?
It is the goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. That's true. That's so beautiful. That's nice. That's really cool. That's really, really good. You were also, when we first started the conversation here, said something about, we remember we were talking about Frederick Cruz?
Yeah.
Yeah, that Kuhn. So then you were saying something about... probably he had a bad analyst, right? Remember when you said that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. What makes a bad analyst? I mean, the main, like, the skeleton of what is that like?
I mean, I think I worry about the analyst putting themselves in the position of knowledge. You know, where they already think that they know something. And so that you start to feel as a patient as if this something's just being imposed upon you, some kind of grid, some kind of system, some kind of prefabricated interpretations. Mm-hmm. And I think that if that's the case, like if there's a kind of prefabricated knowledge that the analyst is using to approach patients, that it's inevitably going to be moralistic and conservative, in which case you're just going to traumatize patient again in some way,
yeah.
With you know, kind of super ego injunctions, and they're not gonna find that amazing space that you can find in analysis to worse. I mean, you can have like an overly empathic person who puts all their feelings all over you, and you know, maybe that works for some people. I think that that would be fine. The other one would be more of a problem. You got someone who is like super touchy-feely, like maybe you could find some room in that analysis to discover something.
Yeah.
But in the other one, I think I feel like I feel the suffocation of the freedom of analysis.
Yeah, definitely. It feels, I don't know, when you're studying to become an analyst and you're trying to, you know, you're trying your best to look you know, to look good and to do the whole thing and to go through the whole thing they want you to go through. And in the middle of it, sometimes you're just like wondering, like, you know, it feels like a very bureaucratic, like, you know, this is just red tape, actually, that I have to go through just to get all this. But you want to do it because you want to do it properly. But I don't think these things are actually said, you know what I mean? Like, you know, you don't have a lot of people coming around and saying, like, you know what makes a bad analyst? And they're just like making a couple of bullet points, you know? You don't have a lot of that. That's a shame, you know? Yeah. I wish you could have more of that. When you're like, you know, having people studying, you know, these points and thinking about it and all this stuff, you know? And obviously you're going to have the chance to ask, like, maybe if you're lucky, you're going to have, you know, the chance to ask like an experienced analyst. And it's always really super hard to get a straight answer. You know what I mean?
Lacan said it. I mean, it was a real relief to me because I think my experience was that I was horrified by a lot of what I was seeing in my profession. And then to read him, I remember at one point he says that if a teacher doesn't understand the important place of non-knowledge, then he'll never transmit anything to his students and he will only ever produce a mediocre psychoanalyst.
I understand. That's true.
And I mean, he's categorical at that moment. And, you know, I even go back to the days where they taught us things like, back to Otto Kernberg, transference-focused psychotherapy, where you had a script. You had like a limited set of interpretations that you had to deliver to the patient.
That's kind of crazy, right?
Wow. Oh,
that's just insane. That's wild. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, and in some ways, I can understand. I mean, he's not as bad as like a CBT person because he thinks dynamically. But the idea was to try to get the analyst to focus on the here and now transference, which is hard for analysts in the beginning. Mm-hmm. They want to mm-hmm. make historical interpretations. They don't want to challenge the patient in their immediate relationship to the person of the therapist. It's hard to get a trainee to do that. And so this method was supposed to force them to do it. Mm-hmm. That's not a good way to teach someone to do that.
You're not actually teaching them.
You're not actually teaching them. And if you give them a script to read that's helping them overcome their anxiety, they're never going to overcome their anxiety. They're just going to have a script for the rest
of their life. Yeah, right? Like, duh. Right? It feels kind of obvious now, right? Yeah. Yeah. That is true. Yeah. That's great. That's kind of crazy. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. It feels a little weird sometimes when you think about that, you know, when you think about all these things, but I understand your points. I think it's actually fascinating when you think through that perspective. That is kind of true, you know? Yeah. I don't know. Do you have any piece of advice? Wait. I have one final question because I don't want to take up, you know, all of your Sunday time. But I got into a debate, like a debate, maybe that's a stretch. But, you know, I got into a conversation with a couple of people and they were just like trying to make it like very clear. That's their idea, that for you to be a psychoanalyst, it would be very important for you to have like a spot-free life, that your life was not that problematic, you know, so that you could be able to understand like what's going on with other people's lives and all those things. And if you had like a problematic childhood or a problematic, I don't know, adolescence or something, that would be somehow detrimental to the job, you know, that was going to be something crazy if you wanted to become an analyst. And I remember first, like, going back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, like we were talking about Freud and the cocaine and all that stuff and the young Freud, you know, like this myth that is out there. And you think about all these guys, they were kind of really problematic individuals, you know, even though they were doing something that was not really giving much of that up, you know. Would you agree with that? What's your take on that, you know? Like, oh, you have, you know, like, it's not really nice to have like a psychoanalyst who has been a real damaged individual in the past, or that had a lot of problems in the past, or something like that. You're supposed to be somebody that is a little bit more, you know, in control. Like, oh no, everything's okay. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I hope the people who said this to you weren't psychoanalysts. I mean, that's bananas, because it's a fantasy of every patient that their analyst is either spotless or now spotless, because it's some fantasy about yourself. So I mean, I live with this. I mean, my partner was in analysis, and I think at some point he said to me, like, I thought that you were supposed to be like sane and even keeled. And I was like, where'd you get that idea? And he's like, I'm like, that's the silliest thing I've ever heard. But it's a fantasy, and I appreciate the fact that for a patient who's very vulnerable and putting themselves into the trust of the analyst, that they need that fantasy. So we are in a very funny position in terms of representing ourselves publicly, where you have to understand that the patient needs to believe that there's something solid in you. And indeed, the idea that you've been through an analysis means that you found some ground subjectively. But the idea that you had that to begin with, or, you know, should have it ultimately, is wrong. And, you know, I mean, just to give a little background, I'm working on analysts' experience of their analysis. There's an old book called Psychoanalysts Speak that has interviews with some very famous analysts, Hannah Siegel being one of them, Francis Tustin being another.
Oh, I haven't read that. Yeah.
And
yeah,
they speak about how sick they were. It's great. It's really beautiful. Frances Tustin in particular moved me because she was in a 16-year analysis with Bion that she says she doesn't remember at all. In the first 6 years of it, she thought he was a nuisance. And then she talks about how depressed her mother was and how superficial her mother was and how she must have been this kind of person and she must have really drove him crazy because she really refused to investigate anything about herself. It's really beautiful because she went on to be one of the most important analysts of autistic children. And this experience she has of a wall that was impenetrable for 6 years that he tried and tried and tried to break down little by little, you know, it must have come from this analysis. And then interestingly, after 16 years, she said that she herself did not know why, but she just left her analysis out of nowhere. And he said something like, I don't think it's a good idea. And she was like, well, I'm leaving. And then she never came back after 16 years. And then she says that she fell into a complete kind of phobic symptom a year later, mm-hmm. like new symptom where she couldn't go, like agoraphobia, couldn't go outside, which she then analyzed and worked on in herself to resolve it. And that was the first time that she felt that she used the analysis herself by herself, and that maybe she needed to do it without Beyond. She also says that looking back on it, because he was about to leave for America, he did leave for America a few years after she ended, that maybe she already knew that he was leaving and she left in advance of his
life. Right.
So, I mean, it's so beautiful because this is not the story of the spotless person or the person who has the ending and they're all cured and unsymptomatic, but someone who made huge contributions to the field and who clearly suffered enormously and could speak about it very powerfully.
And wouldn't shy away, right? From talking about it. Yeah. That's just great.
Yeah. She also says, and this is surprising, that Beyond never once spoke to her about her past. She spoke about it, but he did not do it. He didn't make these kind of genetic interpretations of your mother, your father, whatever. Which is incredible. In 16 years. Yeah. I mean, it's real rigor.
What? What is the name of the book again, Jameson?
Psychoanalyst's Talk.
Okay. I got to read that one.
Yeah.
That's
really
great.
It's really, really nice interviews.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's amazing. That sounds like a great story. Yeah. That goes against all that stuff I was asking you about, yeah. Right? Yeah. Like, oh, you know, maybe you've got to be this one person. I don't know. That sounds like baloney now. But, you know, yeah, that's okay. That's pretty cool. That's good. It's good. That's amazing. Well, I would like to thank you so much for taking 1 hour and 16 minutes of your time on a Sunday to talk to me about, you know, all those things. That's just great.
Thank you for bringing me back to the 90s. I think it's an important moment for the reinvention of analysis now that we talked about it. So,
right?
There's more there to be said, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you for taking the time, and I really appreciate it. Thank you for the picture. I think the conversation with my daughters was something like, they got the book, The 50 Shrinks, you know? And in the you're in the back cover?
Yeah.
That's such a great picture. Is that your office?
That was my first office, yeah.
That was your first office. Okay, all right. And they were just like, is that the same woman from the thing? Is this like real? You know, they were just kind of a little confused. Yeah. The woman that is falling, you know, it's funny because you're falling now. Yeah, yeah. You're forever falling.
I'm forever mid-fall, which is
yeah. Yeah. That's great. But thank you so much for that. And I really appreciate it. Okay.
Yeah. Let's talk about we'll go more in depth in the 90s in another.
Yeah, interview. Definitely. Let's do that. Let's psychoanalyze the 90s. That would be interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jameson.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
No, it's the nostalgia for our children, right? The 90s, yeah. They're all completely nostalgic about the 90s because it's pre-internet. Yeah.
Isn't that the thing? I think that's the thing, right? Yeah. That's a pseudo rhetoric we're still using when we're talking about, like, you don't valorize your music enough, or you don't know what is it, you know, what's like to, you know, like have to, you know, rent, go to Blockbuster and rent a movie, you know, right. this stuff. Yeah. That's kind of crazy. And they're just like, what? What are you talking about? You know, like, no, I don't know what's that. But thank you so much. Thank you again. Okay. I'll talk to you. Bye-bye.
Right. Bye.
See you. Bye-bye.